from the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. This is the Real Estate Hour on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Here's your host, Bob Lane.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Real Estate Hour here on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM, Channel 111. It's great to have you today. As you've been warned, I'm your host, Bob Lane. I'm an adjunct professor teaching real estate law and transactions here at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. And my day job is I'm a practicing commercial real estate lawyer as a partner at the law firm of Stevens & Lee, which I've been doing for more years than I'm going to confess on the air. We're now live at noon Eastern every Friday, followed by Behind the Markets at 1 p.m. Eastern. As always, you can access past shows via our on-demand feature. If you're listening today on Friday, July 15th, we're live in the studio, and please feel free to phone in with any of your questions, comments, thoughts, experiences. And our number is 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. And if you're listening to a rebroadcast, we're always happy to deal with your questions, which you can email us. Either you can email us today, but at any time, and we'll respond to your questions at the next show at businessradio@siriusxm.com. And of course, you may follow us on Twitter at bizradio, B-I-Z-R-A-D-I-O 111. Again, our phone number is 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. We are really fortunate today to have a very popular guest on this show, David Gorenberg. David is a good friend and renowned throughout the United States in 1031 exchanges, which we're going to learn a lot about today. David's the former head of the Citibank's National 1031 Exchange Service, and he's presently the Executive Vice President and Counsel of Riverside 1031 LLC, a terrific 1031 exchange company that's very nimble and growing. And David's going to tell you a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But our theme today is going to be how to use, understand 1031 exchanges, like-kind exchanges, for tax benefits and for other purposes, as you're going to learn, and what real estate owners seeking to avoid or minimize capital gain or income taxes, depending on their situation, need to know about the Internal Revenue Code provision. And of course, we welcome your calls throughout our hour, whether on our topic today or in any real estate matter, which we'd be happy to try to address. And again, our number is 1-844-WHARTON. 1-844-942-7866. And now, let me officially welcome our guest, David Gorenberg. David, welcome.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's good to be here.
It's always a pleasure to have you. Maybe we could start out with, I gave a very brief introduction as to what you do, but maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about your background and how you got into this very, very sophisticated niche of tax and real estate.
Thank you. Well, my background is I was a practicing attorney with a practice in South Jersey. I handled business and real estate transactions, among other things. Landlords, tenants, residential, commercial, buy, sell, all of it. And one day I woke up, didn't like the traditional practice of law. And the next thing I know, I found myself working for a company where I was a full-time qualified intermediary.
I keep waiting to wake up that morning and realize that there's something else out there. But
yeah, well, I didn't realize that there was a career as a full-time qualified intermediary. I had represented clients who were doing 1031 exchanges, but I didn't know there was a full-time career to act as the intermediary.
And you've made a fantastic career out
Thank
of
you.
It.
Yeah. Thank you.
We're going to get into exactly what a 1031 exchange is, but we have a caller right to start the hour off, who I'm going to take just to see, sort of get us primed. And then for those listeners who really don't know much about 1031s, although it may be that the call will help us give an explanation.
Perfect.
So we have Mark from New York. Mark, welcome to Real Estate Hour on Business Radio. How can we help you?
Well, thank you very much. I purchased a multi-family apartment, and I ended up doing a deed in lieu to take possession of it. So my basis is very low, and I've subsequently done a major upgrade of the property and created a lot of value. Right now, I'm the sole member in the LLC that owns it. And basically, I'm looking to cash out without selling 100% of my interest. For example, like sell 50% of my interest and cash out some of the value. And I'm somewhat familiar with the 1031 exchanges, but I'm not sure if that would work in this case.
Okay, Mark, you've actually raised a number of issues in your question, and we're going to have to explain a good bit, I think, to our listeners. So you stay on the line, and we're going to come back to your specific situation, but I think we have to lay a little bit of foundation for our listeners. And David's going to give a much more helpful explanation, but generally, 1031 is a section of the Internal Revenue Code. That's why they're called 1031 exchanges. And this section of the Internal Revenue Code provides that you can swap or exchange property of like kind that's held in trade or business. David will go into this. It's not your personal residence. It's got to be, and it doesn't have to be real estate. You can swap your stamp collection for somebody else's stamp collection. Whether you can swap a stamp collection for a coin collection, we're going to hear more about later on. But the point being that if you were to sell your real estate that's worth, that you bought as Mark's situation with very low basis, what Mark means about low basis is that his cost is cost basis is very low. So when he sells it, his profit will be most of what's, of what he gains. I mean, if you buy something for $900,000 and sell it for $900,000, there's no tax on that $900,000. I'm oversimplifying because you haven't gained. If you bought it for $1 and sold it for $900,000, you have to pay tax on that full $900,000. And whether it's capital gains or ordinary income will depend on the situation. Generally, most of us, it's going to be capital gains. But with that simple explanation, what the 1031 allows you to do is instead of paying tax when you sell, you can hold that money in a very elaborate way, which is where David comes in, and buy something else and make it an exchange, and you don't pay any taxes until later. So, David, if you want to either add to that explanation, perhaps give a little tutorial, and then we can address Mark's situation.
Yeah, first I want to applaud Mark for calling early rather than late. I mean, I can't tell you how many times people call literally hours before their real estate closing, and I can't do much to help them change structures and things. But
you mean calling for advice on 1031,
correct?
Not calling early in the hour on
yes,
our radio
calling
show.
Early in the hour, right, exactly. So to elaborate more on your points, Bob, the essential premise of a 1031 exchange, if you were to ask the IRS, is that you have an investment today, and not that you're selling in your investment and buying a new investment, but that you're picking up your investment from the north side of the street, carrying it across the street, and putting the same investment back down on the other side of the street. That's why they call it a like-kind exchange. They want you to have a similar asset at the end of the day. When we talk about like-kind in real estate, the definition of like-kind is very broad. That is, a single-family rental is like-kind to a multifamily rental, to raw land, to a commercial piece of property. All of those things are like-kind. When the essential structure of a 1031 exchange, for people who aren't familiar, I used to tell my daughter when she was about 6 or 7 years old that what I do is I help people play Monopoly with real property and real money and avoid paying tax on the profit when they sell Pennsylvania Avenue so that they can buy Boardwalk. And as a six-year-old, she understood that. So I'm not to demean any of our listeners. I hope that simplifies it enough so that everybody who's listening can now understand what a 1031 exchange is.
Well, so the key is that what David is saying is that real estate is very unusual in 1031 exchange vernacular, or because any piece of real estate is of like kind with any other kind of real estate.
Correct.
So you can get the benefit of this provision if you own timberland in Alaska, And you want to sell that and use the proceeds to buy investment condos in Florida.
Correct.
It's not necessarily the case that like-kind is that quite that broad in other asset classes. It certainly not doesn't apply to securities. You can't exchange stock in one company for another. So that's going to segue into Mark's situation, which is he said that he owns this property. Mark, correct me. As an LLC.
Correct.
And you're the sole member, which means it's similar to corporations. You have shareholders, partnerships, you have partnership interests, LLC, which are limited liability companies. We call the owners members of that. So you're the sole member. So it's really the LLC that is going to exchange, if you're going to use a 1031 mechanism, it's the LLC that's going to have to swap, not you, swapping your LLC company, and that could be relevant in a number of situations. Now, let me just add one thing to for our listeners, which we're going to get into a lot of detail over the course of the hour, is that when we say swap, we're just being sort of euphemistic, and it's called the 1031 exchange. And at the very beginning of this, people thought you actually had to give my deed for Boardwalk for your deed to Park Place. Not that anybody would make that swap, but that would be the way it would work. Now you can sell your deed to Boardwalk, put that money in a special place, and that's what we're going to get into a lot of the detail, because you can't take the money. You've got to keep the money in what's called a qualified intermediary. We'll get to that. And then within a certain period of time, there's very strict rules, spend that money on buying something else. So it doesn't have to be simultaneous. It's called a deferred exchange. So, Mark, let's come back to exactly, if you would sort of repeat for our listeners exactly what your situation is, that now that we've sort of given the big picture as to how your situation might apply to this.
So what I did is I bought basically a distressed multi-family property and through this LLC. And then in the last 24 months, I've done major upgrades and, you know, significantly increased the NOI. So I've created a lot of value. And basically now I want to take some of that value out and for another, you know, for my next deal, wherever that may be, with and try to minimize the tax implication.
You're on, David.
Okay. Mark, this is a situation that shows up in many variations, many flavors of the same basic theme. And what I see folks in your shoes want to do is they want to try to bring in other members into the LLC. And while you can do that to raise funds, that's not going to be within Section 1031. If you want your basic theme here to be a 1031 compliant transaction, your LLC is actually going to sell some portion, some percentage of its interest in the real estate. Your LLC currently owns the entire real estate. I'm going to call it the Mark LLC. Mark LLC owns 100% of the real estate, and Mark LLC could sell either to me or to several folks percentages. So let's assume for a moment that you sell 10% each to four other people. So you're going to sell 10% to the David LLC, 10% to the Bob LLC, 10% to the Patty LLC, 10% to the Joey LLC, and we would all take title as tenants in common. That's what would go on.
Now, the problem there, Mark, is that rarely do people want to own a minority interest as a tenant in common with someone, unless it's people that you know, your friends or family, in which case it's the LLC that's doing it. You can't just bring other people into the LLC. But basically, to answer your overall question, this is a great thought. You've bought a distressed property with very low basis. You've improved it, so that gets added to your basis. But nevertheless, you carry over that basis. If you want to swap this property, sell it, use that money to buy something else. So, in fact, we're going to get now into the mechanism of how to do that. So, Mark, I want to thank you for your call. That was terrific to get us started out. And we're going to let you go. I want to just welcome our new listeners. It's now 15 minutes into our hour. For those who've tuned in after we started, you're listening to the Real Estate Hour on Sirius XM 111. I'm your host, Bob Lane. I'm an adjunct professor at the teaching real estate law and transactions at the Wharton School by night. And my day job is I'm a commercial real estate lawyer practicing as a partner at Stevens & Lee based here in Philadelphia, but with a practice pretty much all over the country. Our guest today is David Gorenberg, who is a 1031 exchange specialist, and we've talked a good bit about his background, and you'll hear more about it as we go on. And please don't hesitate to call us with your questions, as Mark just did. Our number is 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. And if you're listening on Friday, July 15th, you can call us. We're here live. And if you're listening at another time, please email your questions to businessradio@siriusxm.com, and we'll look forward to addressing them on our next show. So, David, we alluded to in addressing Mark's question a whole bunch of things. And the key is that very rarely, as I understand it, in my practice, having us on the lawyer side, done a number of these, and in fact worked with you as the person who arranges these things often, it's almost never people actually show up at a closing table and exchange deeds for real estate. It's done, as we said, a deferred exchange. So how does that work? What are the rules? How does somebody take advantage of that? And what are the dangers in doing that?
Okay, so essentially what happens is, you're right, very rarely do two people show up and sign deeds and turn the lazy Susan 180 degrees and walk out with the other person's deed. What typically happens is the client shows up at the closing on the first property, on the sale of their first property, and through the preparation of various legal documents, the proceeds, the cash that otherwise would have gone to them, gets forwarded to the qualified intermediary to hold in trust or in escrow on behalf of that particular taxpayer. From that date, that taxpayer would have 45 days within which to identify their potential replacement properties, and 180 days to actually buy something from that list. And then at the other end, when they are buying, again, the intermediary will coordinate with counsel and the other parties to the transaction to make sure that the proceeds show up, that the paperwork is prepared properly.
Now, David, let's say you're Mark or somebody else who wants to sell their property and ultimately use this this mechanism, this advantage, this tax advantage. And you have a buyer who wants to buy and close right away, and it's a terrific opportunity, and you don't want to lose it. Maybe the buyer is using 1031 money from his or her last transaction and has a deadline. So you want to go to closing right away, but you don't know what property you want to buy yet.
So that's where the statute has some nice cushions for you. You don't have to know today what property you're going to buy. In fact, rarely do my clients know today when they're going to closing what property they're going to buy. They may know what they want to buy. They want to buy multifamily in Chester County, or residential, single family residentials in Brooklyn, whatever. They may know that, but they don't know specifically what property. So they have 45 days from closing to present to the intermediary a list of potential replacement properties.
Okay, so when you're closing on your first deal, you have to have retained this qualified intermediary.
The intermediary needs to be in place before closing, correct?
Okay, and so that's where you or your company would come in, or similar ones, is that you can't just pick, your own lawyer or your own accountant. In fact, there are specific rules that you cannot pick anyone that has any relationship with you. Is that correct?
That's correct. Your specific attorney and accountant are specifically excluded, as are some other folks, but those would be the first two that you would otherwise go to.
That's why I use that example. But you can't use your brother-in-law, your mother-in-law.
Nobody related by blood or by marriage or direct business relationship
contract.
Or by contract.
Right. So, and that's where the part of qualified intermediary comes in. It's got to be someone who meets a number of tests. And that's why you are well advised to find someone like David or someone else, but who is, got a track record, and is also got credibility and creditworthiness. I'm going to interrupt a bit. there's a caution to everybody that there's a very famous situation where a very major, highly regarded, well-known company that had a 1031 business as part of it was using the money that they held. And at the time, there wasn't a law against it. But they were using that money while they held it for investment purposes. And then we had the recession tanked. And they were left without enough money to meet their obligations, went into bankruptcy. And the people whose money they were holding were out of luck. And there were lots and lots of real tragic situations. So make sure that you're dealing with a company with good credentials and you check them out thoroughly. Okay, so you've identified, to come back to the mechanism, you've identified within the first 45 days a list of properties. And since I know I want to buy something in Philadelphia, because I live in Philadelphia, let's say, can I just hand you the phone book?
That would be wonderful. The problem is that the, again, the IRS views this as an investment, as a business tool, rather than something that you're doing for convenience or for tax avoidance purpose. So there are regulations that say that you can only identify, well, there's actually a three-step test. Step number one is identify a list of up to three properties. So if you give me a list that is three properties or fewer, no further questions asked. However, if for whatever reason you decide you want to identify more than three properties, in your case using the phone book, then the total value of everything on that list cannot be more than two times the value of what you just sold. So if Mark just sold a $1 million property and he wishes to give me the phone book, it's a pretty safe bet that the value of the properties in the phone book is worth more than $2 million.
Right. So you really have to use a limited number.
Correct.
And then you have to buy from that list within 180 days.
180 days or the due date of your tax return,
whichever
comes first. So for the typical taxpayer who files in April 15th for a January 1 to December 31 tax year, if you start your 1031 exchange, that is you sell your first property the second half of October or later in the year, November 1st.
Let's say in January of that year.
Well, if you sell it in January, you've got 180 days. That takes you into June. But if you sell on November 1st, 45 days from November 1st is December 15th. That's fine. But 180 days from November 1st is May 1st.
So why?
You have to complete your tax return. You have to complete your exchange before you file your tax return.
So if it's on January 1st that you've done your first step,
that's the beginning of the tax year. So I've got all the time I want.
Oh, I see. It's in the prior tax year.
Correct.
I see.
Right. So if I start my exchange, if I sell my relinquished property on December 1st, 180 days from December 1st takes me into May.
Got it. Okay. So what if the properties aren't of equal value? So let's say you've sold your property for $1 million. And you want to buy a $2 million property. Let's take the easy case first.
The easy case first. I love it. You can always trade up. In fact, the mantra is trade up, right? Exchange, 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 and always trade up equal or greater in value. And if you do that, you don't have any problems.
Right. So you use the $1 million from the first sale, and you can add anything you want to it.
You can add additional cash. You can take a bigger mortgage. However you want to get there, you can do that. No problems.
Now, is this money as it looks like on paper, or is it real money in the sense that you sell the first property for $1 million and you have $1 million in cash and you put that in a bank account with the qualified intermediary, with David Gorenberg. And now the next property I want to buy is, say, $1 million, just to make it easy. But in this case, I want to borrow $800,000. I want to borrow 80%. And then take the other $800,000 that you've got in the bank and stick it in my pocket.
Okay.
But I'm buying a property for $1 million.
Well, so there's, again, multiple steps. You certainly want to trade equal or up in value when you've done that, but you also need to make sure that all of your equity, all of the cash, goes into that same property. So if it was a $1 million cash sale, then $1 million worth of cash must go into the next property, or there will be tax consequences. It's not that your exchange fails immediately because you put $800,000 in your pocket. It's just there's going to be a potential taxable event for up to $800,000.
Yeah. Okay, so let's take the tougher one. So you've sold for $1 million, and now you only want to buy a $500,000 property.
Okay.
And keep the other $500,000, regardless of financing. How does that work?
It's very similar to the all-cash deal that we discussed a moment ago. Here, we're selling for $1 million, and again, regardless of whether it's all cash or there is some debt, the $500,000 that we do not reinvest, whether it's I paid off a $500,000 mortgage and don't have any mortgage on my new property, or I sold for $1 million and kept $500,000 in my pocket, that $500,000 that I do not reinvest becomes a taxable event.
Okay. And if my basis in the first property, my cost basis, so from what I'm, so if I bought it for $500,000, let's say the basis didn't change, and your cost is your basis for this purpose, it's a term of art, and that can get that can go up as you invest more money in the property by making structural improvements. It can go down if you depreciate the property. But let's assume for this purpose it hasn't changed at all. So you bought it for $500,000, you're selling it for $1 million. Okay, you're going to use $500,000 to reinvest. Can you say that's the $500,000 that's the profit?
You know, the example I give frequently is if we went down to the casinos this afternoon with $1,000 in our pocket, we were playing for a couple of hours, and now there's $2,000 on the table. I don't know about you, but I'm putting my $1,000 back in my pocket. Well, the IRS says, that's nice, I like the way you think, except the first $1,000 that you put in your pocket, according to the IRS, is their money, not yours. It's not your original seed money, it's the profits. So no, to the IRS's view, that $500 that you kept in your pocket was the profits, not your seed money.
Okay. So do you have to pay tax on that full $500, or is it pro rata in some way?
Well, it depends on the finances of the entire transaction. What was it that we sold? What was the basis? I think here we said the basis initially was $500,000, and we're selling for $1 million. So if we bought it for $500, we're selling it for $1 million, and we're keeping $500 out, there's nothing there that's getting sheltered in that scenario.
Not a penny.
Not a penny.
So it's not half. It's not.
It's half. Not half. It's the
Which
whole
many,
thing.
Many people do assume it's, correct. It's half, but it's not.
Correct.
Okay. We're going to get into a lot more detail after our break. But for our listeners, you've been listening to the Real Estate Hour on Sirius XM 111. I'm your host, Bob Lane, a commercial real estate lawyer by day and an adjunct professor teaching at the Wharton School by night. And our guest is David Gorenberg, who's going to stay with us after our break. So please stay with us. And during the break, you can call with your questions at 1-844-WHARTON, 1-844-942-7866, or email in your questions as we always take. At businessradio@siriusxm.com, and we'll pick you up right after our interlude. Thanks. See you soon.
You're listening to The Real Estate Hour on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM 111. Here again is Bob Lane.
Welcome back, listeners, and thank those listeners who were with us from the start of our hour. Thanks for staying with us, and welcome to our new listeners. For those who are new, this is the Real Estate Hour on Business Radio, Sirius XM 111, powered by the Wharton School, and I'm your host, Bob Lane. I'm a commercial real estate lawyer practicing at Stevens & Lee by day, and my moonlighting job is I'm an adjunct professor teaching real estate law and transactions at the Wharton School here in Pennsylvania. And today we're very honored to have a very popular repeat guest by popular demand, David Gorenberg, the former head of Citibank's 1031 Exchange Company and the current executive vice president and counsel of Riverside 1031 Exchanges. Please call us throughout the balance of our show at 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866 if you have any questions, or email them at businessradio@siriusxm.com. And if you're listening on Friday, July 15th, we're here live and we can respond. Otherwise, we'll respond on the next show to any email questions. So let me... before, there's a bunch of things we want to talk about, but we have a couple of callers who have been waiting. We have Richard from Boston. Richard, welcome to the Real Estate Hour on Sirius XM. How can we help you?
Hey, Bob, great show. Question, can I buy property first and then sell my property to get the 1031, or do you have to sell first?
That's a wonderful question.
That is a question.
That's a good question.
Thank you, Richard. That's a great question. And we were going to come to that, so we're going to start our bottom of the hour with that. We talked about a deferred exchange where you sell first and keep the money to use to buy something else. What you're talking about is a reverse exchange. David?
Yeah, so a reverse exchange. This is a wonder. Typically, this scenario comes up in one of a couple of ways. There are certainly many others, but typically it's either Richard found out about a deal, a property that may be coming on the market, and he wants to take it down before it gets exposed to the market. So he's going to make an offer, and he's going to, in this case, he's successful, but he hasn't yet sold his property. The other situation that comes into play on occasion is a business that is expanding and has outgrown its current facilities, so they need to buy their new facilities first before they can move in. So what happens with Richard's situation is, yes, you can buy first, sell second. There's a specific revenue procedure that deals with how that works. Richard would buy his new property today, and then just like in a delayed exchange, he would have 45 days within which to identify what he owns that he wishes to sell, and a total of 180 days to sell it.
So instead of the money being held by the qualified intermediary, in this case, the deed is held by
exactly. The
qualified intermediary.
Yeah, according to the revenue procedure, what happens is Richard can't own both properties at the same time, so the intermediary, through the use of an exchange accommodation title holder, would hold the deed for Richard in trust and would lease the property to Richard, typically for $10 or $100, something like that. And Richard can use the property as if it were his own before he sells what he
has. Because I was going to ask whether the quote buyer, although not technically, could occupy and use and have the benefit of the property, and it would be done that way through a lease from the...
Correct. Now, the biggest hurdle here, though, is that if Richard needs a lender to buy that new property, some lenders are skittish about property where the deed is now going to be held by me, but they're lending the money to Richard.
And I've had those transactions, and they can be difficult if you don't have a sophisticated lender. Richard, thanks so much for that call. That's a very good one, and we were going to get to that. So we've, I think, really given a good thumbnail pretty quickly. We've got Don from Florida. Don, you have a commercial property question, or is it a 1031 question? How can we help you?
Yes, I bought a piece of property in Dayton, Ohio, commercial property. And about 10 years ago, had every zoning there was to it. And what happened is the city came in, changed my zoning. I paid $300,000 for the property. I have the property currently for sale. And I had a $450,000 cash offer. But since the zoning was changed, the city has devalued it and said it's only worth $100,000. And basically, they won't let anyone put anything there. And I'm wondering, can I write that off as a loss?
Tell me again what the nature of the property is.
Okay, when I bought the property, yeah. It was a heavy industry. It was had every zoning there was, C4.
Right.
And basically, the city came in and changed the zoning to PUD, further development. And basically, they're telling me that really I can't even sell the property unless the people wants to put what they want to go in there.
Hmm.
And like I said, I have a trucking company presently on it, and I had another trucking company wanting to buy it to use it for just exactly what I'm doing, and they said they cannot do it. And that was a $450,000 cash offer. But the city offered me $100,000 for it.
Yeah. Don, you've got a really tricky situation. Let me say at the outset that, number one, we do not give out any legal advice over the radio. It hasn't come up yet in this hour, but I say this most weeks at our station where we're giving out thoughts and ideas. This is a situation where you're going to need a local Florida lawyer, or more specifically,
Dayton.
In Dayton. Oh, I'm sorry. You said Dayton, Florida, right?
Exactly. in Dayton, Ohio.
Oh, Ohio. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Right now.
Oh, you're in Florida now is how the phone came up, Dayton, Ohio. You're going to need a local lawyer because you've got a few issues there. The general principle is that when a municipality downzones or changes the zoning to make it less valuable, you have no recourse. That's part of, unless it's aimed at you. I mean, there are certain exceptions to that. If there's no rational basis for it and it's just a political challenge for somebody trying to get at a property owner. But if there's any valid planning reasons to change the zoning and your property gets is worth less, you have very little recourse. That's not like condemnation or eminent domain. If all value is taken away, if they change the zoning so the only thing you can do is use it as a public park, then that's just a backhanded way of trying to really condemn or take your property for a public purpose. That's called inverse condemnation, and they would have to pay you for your property, and there's a process for that. But the other issue that you raised is that you are a trucking company and using it as a trucking terminal or service, and you want to sell it to another. Usually, most every state has a grandfather position. It could be called a nonconforming use or a nonconforming property, and you're grandfathered or you're protected in terms of, and another company of the same kind could come in and use it. But again, you're going to have to call a local lawyer to get something specific, more specific on that. But thank you so much for your call. We've got a few other callers waiting. Again, callers, don't hesitate to dial us at 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. Or email in your calls at businessradio@SiriusXM.com. Bill in North Dakota, you want to do a 1031 exchange and you're not sure whether you can. So what's your situation?
Well, I've got a rental apartment that I want to sell. That I don't have any prospects to sell, and a warehouse just came up that I really want to buy, and I have to buy it fast. So I'm doing it backwards, or I'd like to be able to do it backwards, I guess.
Well, it sounds like your question is a lot like the previous one. You've got a situation where a really prime opportunity has presented itself to you that you need to jump on real quick before a competition gets the property. So yes, you're talking about, again, a reverse exchange. You'd need to contact your intermediary early because this does take some structuring, but you can buy the new property first. You would then have up to 45 days to identify what you want to sell. In this case, it's the apartment building, and a total of 180 days to sell that existing building. Like I said, there's some structuring issues that need to get involved with here with the transaction and the planning, and there are some additional costs because it is a reverse exchange. But the good news is that you would now have two rental properties working for you at the same time. So if you can make it work, it can be a very good thing to do.
Bill, thanks for your call. That's a good question. I hope we helped. We have Michelle from Philadelphia. Michelle, thanks for calling. Welcome to the Real Estate Hour. And how can we help you?
Thank you so much for taking my call. I just have a quick question about, I guess you were saying you can trade up equal or greater in value, and that's what's expected. And as sort of like someone in their mid-20s who might just be coming into the, like buying a house or something like that, why would you not, like, could you save money if you bought like a cheaper house? Like, I don't understand, why do you have to buy something that's equal or greater in value, like when you're trading?
Well, Michelle, thanks for your call. That's actually a fabulous question, because if we did not make a few basic things clear, this is our opportunity to do so, because as a common misunderstanding. First, 1031 exchanges do not apply to your personal residence. It's only for business property that is held for trade or business or investment. Is that right, David?
That's correct.
So number one, it wouldn't apply to your home. Now, people will have a home that they may want to convert to a commercial property so that they can swap. So if you've owned a home for 30 years and you bought it for a relatively small amount in a great neighborhood, and now it's worth many, many, many times what it was, you can rent it out for some period of time. That's something David and I have talked about from time to time. I'm going to let you give some detail on that, to convert it to commercial and then do a 1031. But the other point I just want to clarify, Michelle, is that there's no requirement. When David was using, there's no requirement that you trade up. That's just the best way to do it. That's sort of the, you know, that's the easy way to do it. But there's nothing in the statute, meaning the Internal Revenue Code or the regulations, that requires you to buy something for more money or less money or whatever. It's just a matter of whether you get the benefit. So if you, again, if, as I gave the example, you buy something for, you're selling something for $1 million and it cost you $500,000 and you're now going to buy something new for $500,000, you're not really getting any benefit of the exchange because you're going to pay tax on the $500,000, you know, that you put in your pocket anyway. David, for the conversion of a residence to a commercial property, especially for someone young who's bought a house and it's really appreciated rapidly and they want to, you know, what can they do? And there's some other advantages for homeowners that aren't necessarily 1031s.
Right. So if they have a piece of property that they're currently living in or making personal use of and they want to convert it, the very first thing they're going to have to do is actually move out. I mean, that means taking the family pictures off the wall, taking all of their clothing out of the dresser drawers, that kind of stuff. They truly need to move out of the property. They then need to treat the property as a business property, which means filing the appropriate schedules on their tax return, taking all of the appropriate business deductions that you would with any other business property. And it's probably prudent to list it for rent with a local real estate agent, because the IRS could potentially require that you prove to them that you have done your best to earn income or otherwise treat it as a business property as opposed to moving out of your house and locking the door behind you.
Right. So that's good advice. Michelle, thank you so much for your call. I hope we addressed your question, but hopefully you'll buy your home first, but now you'll think about investing in real estate and using this terrific opportunity to, in fact, that's a good segue, David, because if someone bought a property when they're in their 20s, and they spent $100,000 on the property, and they want to have some investment real estate for the rest of their life, for another 60, 70, maybe 100 years, as medical science improves. You've often said that the 1031 exchange is not a tax-free exchange, it's a tax-deferred exchange. So how could you use this? You've bought one property, a little investment property for $100,000, and how do you grow that for the rest of your life without ever paying taxes?
That's a wonderful question. So we buy our first property today for $100,000. And in a few years, however many that may be, when it's worth some more and you want to maybe move to a different part of the county or the other side of the city, whatever it may be, you sell that property as part of a properly structured 1031 exchange and you buy a bigger one. And you keep doing that every however many years. And then maybe after a period of time, you sell one big one and you buy two sort of medium-sized ones. So you sell one property for $1 million. And you buy two properties for $500,000. And every 4 or 7 years, however it may be, you do another 1031 exchange so that eventually, when you're at your ripe old age, you have this nice portfolio of 6 or 8 or 10, however many properties it may be. And then you have all of this wonderful property. And when you die and you have accumulated this portfolio, the taxes that you were deferring all these years go away.
Well, we're going to come right back into that because there's some terrific scenarios that you and I have talked about over time. But first, I just want to welcome any later listeners who might have tuned in since we've given out our number. Please call with any questions or comments. Again, we're live on Friday, July 15th. So please call at 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. I'm your host, Bob Lane. You're listening to Business Radio on Sirius XM 111 with our guest, David Gorenberg, a 1031 exchange specialist. And if you're not listening while we're live today, please email your questions to businessradio@siriusxm.com. So, David, you've just given a terrific example about how somebody could invest in real estate and then keep, well, I'll say, rolling it over for much of their life. So if their real estate is going to double in value much quicker, certainly these days, than it is in a bank account, where interest rates are virtually non-existent. So you buy a property, and then a few years later, maybe it's worth twice as much, and you swap that for twice as much real estate or whatever, and you keep exchanging and exchanging. You're never paying taxes if you exchange for an equal or greater value, which is the point that our caller Michelle had asked about, you know, in terms of that you don't must exchange for something more, but you get the full benefit of the statute if you do. So you keep exchanging up over the course of your lifetime. And you then said there's something great when you, well, everybody is going to die eventually. And in our tax code, if you leave your real estate or any assets, this would apply to stocks and bonds and other things as well in this case, but if you leave your assets to your beneficiary, what happens?
Well, in this case, your beneficiary would inherit that property or those properties at the fair market value as of the date of your death. So their basis in the property becomes the value of the property as of the date you die. So the capital gains tax that you were deferring during each of those 1031 exchanges doesn't get recognized. There may be estate tax issues or inheritance tax issues, different problem for a different radio show. But for the purposes of the 1031 exchange and the topics that we've been discussing today, the depreciation recapture tax, the capital gains tax, don't get recognized.
So if you started investing modestly at $20,000, $100,000, whatever, somewhere, and that grows over the course of your life to maybe several million dollars, if you sold it in your old age, you're going to pay a capital gains on from pretty much zero basis on everything that you're getting from the sale of those many millions of dollars of real estate.
That's correct.
Well, if you leave it to me or to your children or to your spouse or to your heirs, whoever they may be, they inherit it with the basis, not the zero that you've been carrying over, but from exchange to exchange, but for the fair market value, as you said, on the date of when you die. And there's actually more complicated rules as to how it's evaluated. It could be evaluated at 6 months later. And that's beyond the scope of our advice, as you said. And so then if your beneficiary then turns around and sells it right after inheriting it, there may be an estate tax. If there's an estate tax, that's regardless of whether it's money or whether it's real estate. So, that the estate's paying, not the beneficiary. But if the beneficiary turns around and sells it, there's no tax. There's no capital gain.
That's right.
A terrific thing.
That's right.
Now, there's another thing that you've explained that people can do if they've been, have a lifetime, or it doesn't matter, but they have a real estate portfolio and they want to lend it to their heirs. I know I have a lot of clients who have come to me and they've amassed quite a significant portfolio of office buildings, apartment buildings, shopping centers, and they're leaving it to their grandchildren who really have no ability to manage and handle and sell this kind of property. You've had some great ideas for how they can use this 1031 idea for that problem.
Yeah, so several years ago, we had a client who owned a shopping center. And during a routine review of his estate planning, the attorney pointed out that there was one shopping center and it was going to go to four grandchildren under the will. And the estate planning attorney suggested that having one property go to four grandchildren might not be the best way to handle that because it was conceivable that they wouldn't necessarily agree on what to do with it when Grandpa died. So we did a 1031 exchange. Grandpa sold the shopping center and bought four condominiums of exactly equal value in the same building within walking distance of a major university. So essentially what he bought was four units of student housing, and that was his 1031 exchange. Now each of the grandchildren is going to inherit their own individual condominium when grandpa dies.
So in effect, a lifetime of very complex real estate could be reduced to, if you have two heirs or four heirs and you don't want them to be squabbling and deciding what should we sell and what we shouldn't, and one may think they're capable of managing the real estate and another may not, but here you leave them each their own property to do with what they will. Again, it can't be a residential condo that they're going to live in. It has to be an investment.
Correct.
That's why you use the example, perhaps student housing or just a rental. Of course, later on, they can convert it to their own home.
Oh, when they inherit it, they can do with it whatever they wish.
Exactly. So that's good. One of the questions we're talking about, you can't use it for your personal residence. What about vacation or second homes?
Vacation or second homes are also personal use property. So when you sell your property that's up in the Poconos or down at the Jersey Shore, the vast majority of these transactions are not properly 1031 exchanges because they were, in fact, your personal use property. They weren't rented. Some of them never. Some of them may have been rented for a couple of days a year. But the vast majority of those transactions are not properly 1031 exchanges.
Right. One of the things that people always ask, forgetting 1031s for the moment, is, you know, I want to depreciate, I want to rent out my vacation home for part of the year. Can I depreciate it? Can I deduct the mortgage interest? Can I, you know, get some tax benefits just by owning it? And I think, and I'm not a tax lawyer, and again, as I've said before, we do not give out tax advice or any legal advice. This is just ideas for people to pursue on their own for more specific advice for their own situations. But basically, if you use your second home or use this other property down at the beach or in the mountains for, say, less than 2 weeks a year, I think is one rule I recall, and some other specific rules, then you can treat it as a commercial property, even though you do spend some time there. You can have up to 2 weeks as vacation, and then maybe there's other times you're coming to check out the property as the owner of an investment property, and that's up to the situation as to what's appropriate and what's not. Assuming you've managed it that way, can you then use that property for 1031?
Assuming that you've managed it that way, and it is at this point on your example that you've changed, yes, now it sounds like it's a commercial property. Now it sounds like we can do a 1031 exchange.
Good. We don't have more than barely a minute left. One of the things that I like to talk about with you on this is when common property can be, because we can't exchange partnership units or stock in a corporation. A lot of people have tried to have tenancy in common where they all equally own, and I just want to just drop this for a future show. We'll talk about the perils of tenants in common for commercial properties. Those interests are exchangeable. And so for people hear about investments on Wall Street for TICs, TIC, tenancy in common, those are fraught with peril. But that's a teaser for later shows because we're coming down to the end of our hour. And I want to thank you, David, so much for joining us. You've been a terrific guest. And listeners, thank you. Again, join us again next Friday at noon Eastern for the Real Estate Hour. I'm Bob Lane. You've been listening to the Real Estate Hour on Sirius XM 111. I also want to thank our producer, Patty Hall. Terrific. And our sound engineer, Danielle Bruno, for having made us sound terrific. And thank you all, listeners. I hope to speak to you again next week.